Was Harry Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom really an Uncle Tom?
He could escape death if he wanted to by telling the cruel Simon Legree where these two enslaved black women are hiding. But he says, no, Massa, I'm not going to tell you where they are because that would be wrong. And it's exactly because he's not a sellout. That's why he is whipped to death.
That's David S. Reynolds. We talked to him about his terrific new book, Mightier Than the Sword, Uncle Tom's Cabin and the Struggle for America. We'll also hear a 2005 interview from Charles C. Mann about his book, 1491, New Revelations of America Before Columbus. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Harry Beecher Stowe's novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, was the most influential book of its time. It may well have changed the course of our nation's history. Before the book was published, the anti-slavery movement was weak and on the fringe. After Uncle Tom's Cabin's phenomenal success, the best-selling novel of its time, it was outsold only by the Bible, abolition was the popular sentiment of the day. President Lincoln famously was said to have greeted the author as, quote, the little woman who started this great war. Stowe may not have started the Civil War, but as my guest David S. Reynolds argues in his new book, Mightier Than the Sword, she did transform the racial politics of our nation, making it possible for emancipation to succeed. Uncle Tom's Cabin also became the first mass marketing phenomenon. A whole industry grew up around it, producing everything from theatrical adaptations to knickknacks showing scenes from the book. Uncle Tom's Cabin is brilliantly written, a melodrama, yes, but one that rings true because so much of it was based on real people and events that Stowe knew. Her characters are movingly drawn, and her plot is a page-turner. That this was all accomplished by a woman in a time when women were not even allowed to speak in public is all the more remarkable. In Mightier Than a Sword, David S. Reynolds tells a fascinating story of the book's impact on American life and thought. It's almost as much a page-turner as the book it's about. Reynolds has done this before. We've spoken to him about his other wonderful books about American history, John Brown, Abolitionist, and Waking Giant, America in the Age of Jackson. Reynolds teaches English literature and American studies at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Well, David S. Reynolds, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's wonderful to be here, Francesca.
Now, Mightier Than the Sword, Uncle Tom's Cabin. You know, the most famous thing I think that's been said about Harriet Beecher Stowe and this book was what Lincoln told her when he met her. Is this the little woman who made this great war? Was she the little woman who made this great war, the Civil War?
Well, that statement by Lincoln is possibly apocryphal because it wasn't reported until about three decades later by the son of Harriet Beecher Stowe. To me, it does have the ring of truth to it, because what we know about that interview that she had with Lincoln in the White House was a cordial one, and he was kind of joking around, and I can almost hear him saying that sort of half-humorously, greeting her in the White House like that. So, but even if he didn't say it, so many others of the day regarded Harriet Beecher Stowe in that manner. There were even more extreme statements of Southerners who were quite bitter about her for stirring up so much concern over the enslaved blacks of the time. There were 4 million of them at the time, that Southerners were very, very angry with her. And they really charged her and John Brown with being among the individuals, the cultural individuals, the two individuals that really, really stood out as being the cultural forces in the North that galvanized the tensions that led to the Civil War.
Now, first, before we kind of get into the meat of that and what the incredible effect that she really had on the politics of this nation, tell us a little bit about Harriet Beecher Stowe herself. I mean, she came from a pretty illustrious anti-slavery family. She wasn't the only one.
Yeah, she was one of 11 children of Lyman Beecher. He was the most famous clergyman in Connecticut. He had started out in East Hampton, Long Island, then he went to Litchfield, Connecticut. That's where Harry Beecher was born. And she had five siblings by his first wife, and then she had half siblings by his second wife. So there were a total of 11. And among the 11, most of them were reformers. Several of them were anti-slavery reformers. One of them was the famous anti-slavery minister, Henry Ward Beecher, who came out very ardently against slavery. So she and Henry Ward Beecher really stand out among that family for being forces against slavery.
And what was she like?
She's kind of dreamy-eyed, a little bit quiet, somewhat shy. The only time that she went and saw slavery firsthand, she went with a college friend to Kentucky from Ohio, where she then lived. It was across the river in Kentucky. She went to a plantation, and she sat there quietly and looked around and absorbed all these scenes, which later came in Uncle Tom's Cabin. But we know from her letters that she could also be quite sociable to those that she knew well. She did love to talk to friends, and she was a very kind human being. She's someone who also had, I think, a very deep emotional resonance, real deep feelings, and a sense of sympathy for others. She underwent quite a few personal misfortunes in her private life, various obscure illnesses that she was afflicted to, although she lived to age 85. But she lost one son by an accidental drowning, another son by cholera. Another son was wounded at Gettysburg, then became an alcoholic, and he disappeared. Then her daughter, Georgiana, became a morphine addict as a result of trying to treat some illnesses. So she underwent quite a bit of tragedy. And yet, along with that, and with all her sorrow, she still had a deep Christian faith and a fundamental optimism, which even comes through in this very tragic book, Uncle Tom's Cabin. In many ways, it's actually a hopeful book, optimistic book in many senses.
Her Christian faith, it really struck me how that was so intimately woven into the book, Uncle Tom's Cabin. And I did do some reading, by the way, in the book. I'd never read it before. It's quite wonderfully written.
Yes, it is. And I agree with Nicholas Kristof, who in the New York Times put it among the top 10 must-reads, along with some other classics, just a few weeks ago in the New York Times. It's surprising how subtle a book it is in many ways, despite its reputation as being sentimental. And there is some 19th century sentimentality in it, as there are, as there is in Dickens, to some degree, sometimes in Mark Twain, and so forth. But I'll tell you, the characters are very sharply and movingly drawn and individualized. And the way these characters intermeld with each other is really kind of amazing. And the way she manages their language, she duplicates the vernacular quite well. And her descriptions are quite realistic and very, very moving.
So could you give us like a little short synopsis of the book?
Yeah, there are two basic plots. They both involve these enslaved blacks who they all start out together on a Kentucky plantation. But one group goes north. Eliza and George Harris, there's a threat that their little son Harry is going to be sold into the Deep South. So Eliza seizes her little son, and she actually goes across the ice. This was based on a real life story, and she escapes to the north. And then with the aid of white northerners, she makes it to the north. She rejoins her husband, George Harris, who also escapes. And they both end up in Canada. So that's one plot. And then the other plot is on the same plantation, there's the enslaved Uncle Tom. And Uncle Tom is in his 40s. He's a muscular man. He's dignified. He's self-respecting. At the same time, he's very Christian and compassionate and a rather gentle man, a good man. But he's married to this Chloe, this woman Chloe, and they have three kids. And what happens is that his master really likes him and loves his family, but is forced by his financial circumstance to sell Uncle Tom into the Deep South. And so Tom is sold to another, quote, good master, but ultimately ends up in the hands of the evil Simon Legree, down in Louisiana, and he's literally whipped to death by Simon Legree, who has this perverse hatred of this kind of noble black man, Uncle Tom, and has him whipped to death.
Now, during my lifetime, in modern times, Uncle Tom is seen as a rubric for someone who accepts, you know, the racial oppression put on him, someone who is, you know, toadies up to the system. As you point out, Uncle Tom is a self-respecting person. Would you say that it was the idea that we have of Uncle Tom is the one that's in the book, or is it something really different?
No, the image of Uncle Tom became distorted and almost reversed over time, because what happened is that the novel was adapted by many playwrights, by many plays. It became by far the most popular play in American history. It was played everywhere in America, in Canada, in India, in Russia, in China, in Australia, in Siam, as we know from The King and I, where they put on an Uncle Tom play. It's played all over the world, and by hundreds of acting troupes that went out simultaneously. But in some of these dramatic representations, Uncle Tom was falsely presented as an old man, a bald old man, stooped, rheumatic, stooped over a cane, and always saying, "Yes, massa, yes, massa." And so slowly, and particularly these plays that were put on during the Jim Crow era, the era of segregation and discrimination, that version of Uncle Tom sold to the public at that time. And so automatically his name got absorbed and actually got totally reversed. In the novel, as I mentioned, he's a good man, he's compassionate, he loves other people. At the same time, he refuses to betray people of his own race. He could escape death if he wanted to by telling the cruel Simon Legree where these two enslaved black women are hiding. He could escape that, but he says, no, massa, I'm not going to tell you where they are, because that would be wrong. He has a sense of right and wrong, and it's exactly because he's not a sellout. That's why he is whipped to death. So he's exactly the opposite of a sellout. So the image of Uncle Tom has become terribly reversed and distorted.
Another thing that's become reversed, I think, in our modern time is the whole role of evangelical Christianity. Could you talk a little bit about this contrast? How did the evangelicalism, inform the anti-slavery and abolition movement and Harriet Beecher Stowe, and how different it is from today?
Well, ironically, back then, the Democratic Party, which today is the sort of liberal progressive party, was the pro-slavery party. The Republican Party was the anti-slavery party, and in general, Christians, at least Northern Christians, particularly after Henry Ward Beecher and Harriet Beecher Stowe came along, espoused social reform, progressive reform. But what happened over time, now this wasn't true in the South, because there were a lot of Christians in the South who defended slavery, but in the North, particularly after Beecher and Harriet Beecher Stowe came along, it was more and more associated with social reform. But then we went through a period of fundamentalism, and slowly that whole evangelical base shifted much more towards social conservatism. And this happened kind of in the early 20th century. Yes, as I mentioned, there was this period called Jim Crow, which does last till the mid-1950s. And it was really during that long period that it slowly morphed into much closer to what it is today, a kind of a red state mentality.
Mm. We're talking with David S. Reynolds about his terrific new book, Mightier Than the Sword, Uncle Tom's Cabin and the Battle for America. Now, tell us a little bit about the writing of the book. Harriet Beecher Stowe felt that it came from divine inspiration.
Yeah. Back then, there was a very popular movement called spiritualism, which believed that you could literally communicate with the other world. Harriet Beecher Stowe once had a long conversation with the deceased George Eliot, the novelist, the woman novelist. And it was very, very common back there were seances in the Lincoln White House. So it was not unusual to feel like you were writing under divine inspiration back then. And when a friend of hers approached her and said, I think your brother's a little mad because he thinks you're going to get proud or cocky about your success, your incredible success with this book. It sold so many copies. And she said, "Dear Edward, he doesn't have to worry. I didn't write Uncle Tom." And the friend said, "What?" She said, "No, God wrote it." And it first came to her when she was in church, and she had a vision, not of Jesus Christ on the cross, but of a black man being whipped to death. And she went back and she wrote that scene down. And then the rest of the chapters, she said, came to her in a series of visions.
Wow.
Amazing, yeah.
That really is. Now, you mentioned before that many of the scenes in the book are based on things that she actually witnessed or heard of. And one of them was one of the most stirring scenes in the book, that is the escape of Eliza Harris across the ice. Is that the incident where one of Harriet Beecher Stowe's friends, a man who was on the Underground Railroad, he was involved?
Yes, the Reverend John Rankin, who was an abolitionist who lived right by the Ohio River. He had a number of sons, and they all participated on the Underground Railroad because they were just across the river from a slave state, Kentucky. And quite often, to their door late at night, there would arrive an enslaved black man or woman who came up to them and said, "I'm trying to run away," and they would help them along. And one woman came across the ice with her baby, and she made it across, and she made it to Rankin's door. And then Rankin sent the couple on north through the Underground Railroad to various friends. And Harriet Beecher Stowe heard the story from John Rankin. Eventually, a couple of Quakers that helped her out gave her the name of Eliza Harris. And so there was literally a real Eliza Harris on which that incident, which became a really famous incident, particularly in the plays, but also in the novel, became very popular. That dramatic incident of her escaping across the ice became so famous, but it was really based on a real story.
And you mentioned also how popular it became. I mean, the best-selling novel of its time. Talk about the huge success of this book.
Yeah, it was published first in installments in a newspaper called The National Era, so excitement built over the novel as it appeared in monthly installments. But then when it was published in book form in March 1852, it just sold like wildfire. The presses couldn't keep up with it. It sold more than three times as many as copies as any other book in America before that. It sold, in America, it sold 310,000 copies. And then in England, it sold 1 million copies. It was sold like wildfire in England. And then in Europe, it sold another 800,000 copies within the first year. So it was quickly translated into 16 languages. And the sales kept going and going, so that by 1905, the New York Times could still report the two most popular books in the world right now are Uncle Tom's Cabin and the Bible. So just incredible.
It is. And yeah. So why do you think this book had so much success? Yeah.
Because if you read it even today, I've taught this book as an English professor for years and years. And I started out kind of because I'm accustomed to teaching Moby Dick and Scarlet Letter and all these, complex novels. And this book seemed a little simpler to me, and so it didn't affect me. But when I was writing Mightier Than the Sword, I actually started crying when I read the novel, because if you give yourself to the story and to the characters, I think it really does tug at your heartstrings in a very, very deep kind of way. And you see the kind of a horrible situation that these characters are in, and yet they all somehow retain their humanity, and they all kind of come alive before your eyes. And I think it's the sheer humanity of the novel that really makes it universal.
Is it the best of her own writing?
I think it is, and I think she wrote 30 books total. And a lot of them are very, very good. The Minister's Wooing is about early New England, and Poganoc People is about her time in Maine and so forth. And she wrote another anti-slavery novel called Dread. Now, Dread was written a little bit several years after it, when she had become a little more pessimistic about the idea of slavery disappearing as a result of Uncle Tom's nonviolent approach. And so that's a more kind of a darker, bitter kind of book, and not quite as gripping, frankly, and not quite as emotional, and it didn't sell quite as well either. It's still a very fine novel, but none of her other novels, in my view, measure up to the sheer emotional power of Uncle Tom's Cabin.
And we're talking about Harriet Beecher Stowe and Uncle Tom's Cabin with David S. Reynolds. His newest book is Mightier Than the Sword. This novel, Dread, that's not D-R-E-A-D, it's D-R-E-D, just a few years before the Dred Scott decision.
This was just a year before the Dred Scott decision. Now, the Dred Scott decision, of course, stripped African Americans of any rights whatsoever. It said they literally had no rights that white people had to respect. It was just a horrible Supreme Court decision. And it was by coincidence that a year before she had named her novel Dread with the same spelling.
The book was, as you mentioned before, was made into plays. It had an entire merchandising, many merchandising appendages. You said it was probably the first book that ever did have this huge merchandising marketing thing around it. Talk a little bit about that, and then I want to ask you about the plays.
It was, in a sense, our first real example of mass culture, because what happens is that today we become accustomed to Star Wars characters and Superman and everything being disseminated in little figurines and on lunchboxes. And this goes back to Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone and all of that stuff, that this kind of tie-ins. But all this really begins with Uncle Tom's Cabin, because there were jigsaw puzzles. There were restaurant dishes. Even in Paris, you could go and buy Uncle Tom's candy, and you could buy Uncle Tom's shrinkable woolen stockings in London, and it was Uncle Tom dolls and this. And the difference between all of this and Superman and all is that there was a real political message there that was really lacking from a lot of the merely entrepreneurial capitalistic merchandise that usually goes on today.
And it had an incredible impact then through those and through the plays on the working class. I mean, you talk about the roughnecks, you know, the working class Americans who before this had been, by and large, pro-slavery, even helping, you know, to bring back fugitive slaves to their owners. This changed everything around. How did that happen?
Well, the working class, the white working class people of the North, as you mentioned, generally had enjoyed a, quote, Negro hunt as much as British people enjoyed a fox hunt earlier. But when they went and they began to sympathize with these fugitive slave characters in Uncle Tom's Cabin, there was a kind of tidal shift in attitude among a lot of people of the working class. It's not that they became really progressives, because there were the New York City draft riots that came along, and there were elements of racism still there, but still on some kind of gut level, this play alerted them to the horrors of slavery, to the suffering that enslaved blacks were undergoing at that time, in a way that nothing else really did. It kind of moved them, and it became such a popular play. It was put on everywhere, and night after night after night, these working class audiences just filled the theaters.
Well, but you also say that Harry Beecher Stowe had some kind of sympathy for the plight of the free working man, that she had a kind of anti-capitalist stance. Talk about that.
Well, what's funny is that she saw the Civil War as basically almost like a Marxist, as a struggle of the proletariat against the capitalists. There was a side of her, and I think I try to argue in my book that she was actually reading some Karl Marx in the New York Tribune, some of his writings that were coming out at the same time, because he was, of course, publishing his seminal writings just about that moment. Also, her husband read German, so even though his major books weren't published in American English till later on, he kept on going to Germany, and I'm almost convinced that he read some Karl Marx himself. So, and there are moments in Uncle Tom's Cabin where she has characters say, hey, this is part of a larger struggle of the oppressed, both black and white, the workers of the world that are oppressed.
And also she had this, what you call an egalitarian democratic sympathy for black people. Yeah. How do you think it was that she was able to get beyond the prevalent racism of her time, even the racism that was prevalent among those who were anti-slavery?
Yeah, a lot of anti-slavery people were racist. Even Lincoln, who, although he progressed later on in his views of race, said there were essential differences between whites and blacks that would forbid them from living on equal terms in America. And even Harriet Beecher Stowe, in her novel, if you read it, you'll see certain elements of that prevalent racism or racial caricature. But at the same time, for her time, she was very, very progressive when you compare her views for her time. And she had an instinctive emotional sympathy for African Americans that really came from her childhood. There were a couple of family servants who were black, and she was very, very loving When her mother died, she remembered being embraced by this black woman, Zilla, who was one of their maids. And she said, I just had so much feeling at that moment towards Zilla. And then later on, she knew a lot of black people in serving capacities when she lived in Cincinnati, but she heard their stories. Most of them were fugitive slaves, and she actually helped one of them escape to the North. And then when her son Charlie died at 1.5 in 1849, she said, I really felt for the first time what a slave mother must feel when she loses her child, if her child is sold away from her in the Deep South. And she instinctively thought there was a part of her that really reached out to these enslaved blacks, even when her own son died.
And this egalitarianism, you say, shifted the mood of the country toward a greater egalitarianism.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's very easy to go too far, because as I said, elements of racism and non-egalitarianism certainly remain even in the North. But I think that what happens is that in order for the Republican Party, even though it wasn't really progressive in so many ways, but in order for Abraham Lincoln to be elected, he came out against slavery. He said, I'm a part of the party that believes that slavery is morally wrong. And in order for him to actually win the northern states, people were very much aware of his stance on slavery, but they had to kind of get over their indifference over slavery. And the way they got there was through this kind of catalyst of change in public opinion that occurred largely through Uncle Tom's Cabin. And at the same time, an incredible pro-slavery defensive reaction to Uncle Tom's Cabin was generated.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about that.
Well, there were no less than 30 novels, they were called anti-Tom novels, that were published in the decade after Uncle Tom. Even though none of them was as popular as Uncle Tom's Cabin, taken together, there were a substantial body of writing. It was incredible. And then all these books and tracts and essays, all directed against Harriet Beecher Stowe. This pro-slavery ideology arose, and in these novels and in this literature, slavery was presented as a good thing, as a divine institution where they brought so-called ignorant barbarians from Africa and exposed them to the blessings of Western civilization and took care of them and sheltered them. So that's the way they answered Harriet Beecher Stowe.
The book is Mightier Than the Sword, Uncle Tom's Cabin and the Battle for America. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm talking with the author, David S. Reynolds. Stay tuned for more after the break.
No more,
no more
children
now
for me.
No more,
no more.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Coming up, we'll air an excerpt from my 2005 interview with Charles C. Mann about his book, 1491. But first, let's get back to talking with David S. Reynolds. His new book, Mightier Than the Sword, is a story of Harriet Beecher Stowe's literary masterpiece, Uncle Tom's Cabin. It was probably the most influential book ever written in America. You also say that Uncle Tom's Cabin had a lasting impact into modern times. How did that happen?
Well, that is a long story that I cover in the second half of my book. And basically what happens is that this ripple effect of pro-slavery and anti-slavery that it set off before the war was continued during the Jim Crow era, when a lot of white supremacists in the South still were reacting harshly against Mrs. Stowe, who they blamed with bringing on the war and with unleashing these kind of barbaric African Americans, upon the scene. And Thomas Dixon was this Southerner who saw an Uncle Tom play, and he was so outraged by its sympathy for black people that he went home and he wrote, that this was in the early 20th century, wrote these massive bestsellers that were very, very white supremacist, and they endorsed the lynching of blacks. They endorsed the Ku Klux Klan. And he wrote one novel, The Klansman, which became the basis for some people call it the most important movie ever made, The Birth of a Nation. It was important because it was very artistically made. At the same time, it was abhorrent thematically. It made heroes of the Ku Klux Klan. And so this whole dialectic between the Ku Klux Klan people and Birth of a Nation people, and even Gone with the Wind, which is sort of, Margaret Mitchell said she partly wrote that to counteract Uncle Tom's Cabin. So you have that block over on one side, and on the other block, you have the NAACP and W.E.B. Du Bois and Langston Hughes, and you had nine silent films called Uncle Tom's Cabin that were endorsing the other point of view, the Harry Beecher Stowe point of view. And so this incredible dialectic continues right up to the 20th century. And even during the Civil Rights Movement, the phrase Uncle Tom became used in a negative sense, as we were mentioning toward the beginning, by people who wanted to brand certain African Americans as being too timid or something. So it was used as a weapon. But then Rosa Parks said, I don't mind being a gentle resistor. She said, the Uncle Toms have done good, have done well. And she was a very gentle person herself. And in a way, she made as great or even greater a mark on history than some of the more violent and more militant African-Americans at that time. And Martin Luther King was often called by more militant blacks Uncle Tom. And yet he and Rosa Parks kind of stand out as, I mean, their nonviolent, principled, firm, strong resistance in a way vindicates Uncle Tom, and in a way opens the way then for true equality.
David S. Reynolds, you teach English.
Yeah.
I know the first time when I interviewed you, the first time I had to keep on reminding myself that you're not a historian.
Right.
Why? I want to ask you first, why have you chosen this period of history? I mean, you wrote about John Brown and now Harry Beecher Stowe. There's another book in between. I don't remember what that was.
Yeah, I wrote a book called Waking Giant, America in the Age of Jackson, Andrew Jackson.
Oh, that's right. Actually, we talked to you about that one as well.
Yes.
So what is it about, I mean, that's a little earlier than this period, but nonetheless, what is it about this, you know, the first half of the 19th century that is so gripping to you? And how have you, as a teacher of literature, come to really become a historian here?
Yeah, well, it's an evolution. I was raised actually as a Christian Scientist, which was a religion that was based in the 19th century on Mary Baker Eddy, and I became very interested. My first book was on religious literature of the 19th century, and I think kind of my personal familiarity and also my roots go back to the Puritan times, and I was raised in New England. And so much of our great literature came from New England. Harriet Beecher Stowe's roots go back to the Puritans as well. And I somehow I started reading these great books by Melville and Hawthorne and Emerson, Harriet Beecher Stowe and Henry David Thoreau, and I became enthralled by that period. And it's called the American Renaissance, the period just before the Civil War produced, and Poe and Emily Dickinson, all these great writers are from that era. And I got totally enthralled by it. And in a way, I've been kind of trapped in it ever since, but happily entrapped, just because I find it kind of endlessly fascinating, the figures of that era. And it was such an important moment of transition, a moment when, just after the Revolution, when the ideals of equality and democracy were established, but the realities were nowhere near there, near being established. Women couldn't vote. There were 4 million enslaved blacks, on and on and on. So it's incredible. It's a moment of such struggle and turmoil that it's endlessly fascinating. And I never really when I'm teaching my English courses, I really do attend to close reading of literary texts. But for me, history is just a text. It's a bunch of newspapers back there that I, in letters and journals and diaries that I go back there and I read them and I gather information and I interpret them and I put them all together. So to me, both history and literature are not really separate realms. They're all kind of caught up together. And I think that cultural history is so important. And too often today, we have book after book, about Lincoln and about his team of rivals and Civil War generals. And that's all very, very important, but equally important is culture, the cultural forces that is pushing off the, after all, the United States has been pushed for, or dangled really on a string for the last 10 years by a complete, numerically insignificant outside culture group called Al-Qaeda. And that's been dangling the United States kind of in the economy, the wars, everything, just by little. But that's an example of culture acting in a bad way. Culture in a good way are these complete outsiders like Rosa Parks, like Gandhi, like Martin Luther King, like Harriet Beecher Stowe. Sometimes these cultural outliers push us in a very good direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book is just terrific. I've enjoyed every single one of your books. Mightier Than the Sword, Uncle Tom's Cabin, and The Battle for America. David S. Reynolds, thanks so much.
It was wonderful to be with you.
David S. Reynolds. In addition to Mightier Than the Sword, he's the author of Waking Giant, America in the Age of Jackson, and John Brown, Abolitionist. You can hear my interviews with Reynolds about both of those books at writersvoice.net. He also was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for his cultural biography of Walt Whitman. Next up, Charles C. Mann and 1491. Stay tuned.
Follow the drinking gourd. Follow the drinking gourd, for the old man is coming just to carry the freedom. Follow the drinking gourd.
Columbus Day has just come and gone. Next week, we'll talk with Charles C. Mann about his new book, 1493, Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. But in 2005, he came onto Writer's Voice to talk about his bestseller, 1491. In that book, he revealed new research about pre-Columbian America, showing how the native peoples brilliantly reshaped their environment to serve their needs. They created highly sophisticated and flourishing civilizations, not only in Central and South America, but in the North as well. Often they used what we would call today sustainable methods of agriculture and forestry. Here's an extended excerpt from our interview with Charles C. Mann in 2005. Now, you come up with a radically different view on a number of issues than older views of the pre-conquest history of the Americas. Could you lay out some of those major differences?
Yeah, what I should say is it's not so much me. It's that, you know, if there's a contribution to my book, what I've done is visited a whole lot of researchers who have been working kind of isolation from one another and tried to say that when you add up all their work, it comes up to a complete new picture in a way that sometimes the researchers themselves aren't aware of. So that, therefore, you have a whole new generation of scholars in Amazonia who are discovering that far from being a kind of an empty wilderness the way we've been taught, that the Amazon rainforest at the time of Columbus was teeming with people and, in fact, is largely a human artifact. But they didn't know, for instance, because that's not their field, that other historians have been completely reevaluating the way that we should look at the contact between the pilgrims and the various Indians in New England, who don't know that scholars have really done enormous new work on the Maya, some of which is just coming to light, who don't know that other people who are working in Peru who have made, you know, exciting new discoveries. And so I use the journalist privilege of hopping from one place to another to try and say that when you look at all these things together, the cumulative impact is even more than the impact that you have when you look at them separately. So some of the things that they found, for instance, just in the last couple of years, people have discovered that some of the oldest cities and the oldest urban complexes on Earth are on coastal Peru. They've learned that huge epidemic swept through the Americas just in the wake of the very first Europeans to come there, so that many of the colonists who reported wilderness were in fact seeing what the historian Francis Jennings has called a widowed land, a land that had recently been swept clean of most of its inhabitants. And they are also beginning to appreciate to what extent, and this is something particularly fascinating to me, that Indians completely reshaped the environments that they were in. They were not wildernesses. These were heavily managed landscapes, and often managed brilliantly.
Yeah, when you say that the Amazon is a cultural artifact, could you explain what you mean by that?
Well, first, there's all kinds of very interesting new evidence. It's really just emerging in the last few years that the rivers that go through the Amazon has many tributaries, the banks were lined with villages and towns that had extensive agriculture, but it's a form of agriculture that really is just being unraveled now, and it wasn't the kind of slash and burn that we're familiar with now. And the slash and burn agriculture, which is also sometimes called swidden, is when you chop down the trees in the forest, burn it down, what you've chopped down, and clear this area temporarily and plant something and get a few years out of it before the forest grows back. And what they've learned is that they've done something different that's sometimes called slash and char. You did cut it down, but you turned most of the wood that you got down into charcoal, stirred that into the soil, and for complex reasons that scientists are just beginning to unravel, that greatly improved the soil by providing kind of anchors for the microorganisms and fungi that are the soil ecosystem that is what makes soil really rich, and the typical jungle soil doesn't have much of because of the relentless heat and sun. And then, rather than planting annual crops, what they did was manage the succession. They planted orchards of kind of a peach palms and all the various nuts and fruits that we hear so much about from the Amazon. And you do this over centuries, and a significant portion of the Amazon, sort of low estimates are on the order of an eighth, high estimates are, half and even higher, of the Amazon is really the result of repeated plantings of orchards, so that it's what they call an anthropogenic forest, in which the composition of the species and the way that they're planted has been heavily regulated by human beings.
So, in other words, they could have stationary settlements there, is what you're saying,
right?
That could support them, as opposed to the idea that they had to, that they deplete the soil very quickly and then have to move on.
Absolutely. And so the first Spaniards to go down the Amazon, which is the Orellana party and the Aguirre party, both their accounts reported that the banks were filled with, large towns, thousands of people. It was very dicey going down there, in fact, because the Spaniards were so outnumbered. And they would report that there would be, many, many miles of villages, without, as Orellana's, one of the Orellana reports said that there was miles of villages without a, one crossbow bolt between them, which is a couple hundred yards. And so, in the mouth of the Tapajos, there is a very large city that, in theory, could have had as many as 400,000 inhabitants, although that seems probably too large.
And so that's Aguirre of Aguirre, Wrath of God,
the Werner Herzog. He was they were pretty bad guys. That the movie isn't exactly historically accurate, although it's a wonderful movie.
You connect some of these differences. Well, actually, it sounds like all along it's been a very highly politicized scholarship, if you can call it that, of the pre-conquest peoples here that's been done by Europeans, by whites. But you say that given the charged relations between white and native peoples, that the inquiry into Indian culture and history is inevitably contentious. And for example, you talk about the pristine myth. I wonder if you could talk about that in specific, and then if you want, broaden that out too.
Well, sure. I mean, all history is politically charged. We witness the fights that we've had about should the American curriculum emphasize slavery, and should we teach the negative parts of American history. And one of the simple reasons is that we have been taught what they call the pristine myth. The term was invented by the geographer William Denevan of the University of Wisconsin. And a side effect of that is that, if the countryside was a wilderness, then it's kind of okay to move in. It's very uncomfortable to think that the countryside is full of people. Now, there's a big fight also over kind of what you might call intentionality. Was this myth deliberately passed on to make Europeans and their descendants feel better? Maybe. It's clear that a lot of the Europeans who moved into the Midwest and West thought that it was pretty empty. And the reason for that was that they didn't understand what had happened about the diseases that arrived before them.
I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand is that those diseases actually preceded the conquest, as you say, and killed, what, about 96% of
something like that. I mean, you know, this kind of figures are inexact, but I think there's a general agreement that they killed more than 90%, and some people believe, you know, up to 98%. Whatever the figure, it was the greatest demographic catastrophe in the history of humankind. Just a dreadful thing. So you want to, you know, have something so awful happening, you want to assign blame. It was very difficult because neither the Europeans nor the Indians that they contacted had the modern understanding of disease. Europeans, of course, understood contagion. They understood that diseases could be transmitted between people, but they didn't understand the mechanism. And in fact, basically, they understood that a disease could be transmitted, but whether it was, that was the will of God. And the Indians more or less understood it in the same way. Because epidemic disease was, you know, there wasn't much of it in the Americas. They didn't really have any kind of mechanisms of defense like quarantine or, you know, any kind of natural immunity because they hadn't been exposed to it. And so these terrible diseases would sweep through, and it was something beyond their experience. And they have also attributed it to the will of God.
And also just scientifically, is that because they didn't have a practice of domesticating animals that they were so subject to the disease?
Yeah, most of the really bad epidemic diseases, what they call crowd diseases, are animal diseases that have, you know, through a mutation have jumped the species barrier and landed in people. And so smallpox came from, you know, camel pox or horse pox. It's the kind of thing that geneticists argue about. Measles is a variant on bovine rinderpest, which is a cow disease. As we're starting to learn, human influenza comes from, you know, birds, especially ducks. And Europeans and Asians lived around domesticated animals. In fact, they shared their houses with them. By a quirk of evolutionary history, there were very few domesticable animals in the New World, the so-called New World. So you still can't domesticate bison the way you can domesticate cattle. And as a result, Indians just simply didn't live around animals the way that Europeans did, and those kind of crowd diseases didn't ever have a chance to develop. And in fact, you can run this sort of science fictional, you know, alternate world that if that did happen in Europe and Indians had developed their own diseases, well, their lives would have been much more miserable. But when the Europeans came, the slaughter would have been two-way, and it would have been absolutely devastating for both sides.
You're hearing part of a 2005 interview I did with Charles T. Mann about his book about pre-Columbian America, 1491. We'll be talking about his new book, 1493, next week. It's about how the European discovery of the New World changed the ecology of the entire planet and its culture. And now I want to go back to something you said on the other hand of it, and that is that there's also part of this pristine myth is that, you know, the Indians lived in a kind of Edenic integration with nature. But you talk about some of the ecological implications of some recent discoveries. I wonder if you could tell us what they are.
The new perspective from, and this is mainly taken from geographers who have been trying to understand, you know, the broad scale changes in ecosystems over time, is that that Indians, like people everywhere, manage their landscapes. In many cases, they're extraordinarily successful at it. We have, you know, much to learn from them. The pristine myth is that they somehow didn't touch anything, didn't disturb anything, that, you know, people live with like these ghost-like presences. And there's a kind of a curious feeling to say about Indians that they're unique among all people on the earth, this kind of ecological patsies that didn't have any impact on their environment. It's a very odd kind of, I guess the academic term is the essentialist argument, to argue that somehow these people alone had this essence that was different from everybody else. It's kind of creepy when you think about it. But what they are understanding is that these landscapes were thoroughly marked by the human presence. And the political implications of that are that much of, for instance, American environmental laws is animated by the idea that we should return the landscape to its pre-Columbian, you know, essence, which is seen as the wilderness. I mean, that's the idea of the Wilderness Act and so forth. And then to say, well, wait a minute, these landscapes are managed. Conservationists fear that this is, you know, opens the way for the bulldozers, so that developers can say, oh, this wasn't wilderness at all, therefore it's okay to pave it all. That's certainly some people will argue that, but it also suggests to us that what we need to do is not so much to leave the land alone, but be very thoughtful about how we use it. And it's also, to me, it suggests a very hopeful idea that we can work with nature in the way that that they did and create something really nice.
Yeah, there's a lot we can learn from them. And one of the things I loved about your book is how vivid you brought these many different peoples, many different cultures in the Americas really alive. And I was fascinated by your description of how the pilgrims must have appeared to the Massasoit Indians who were here in Massachusetts. Do you have the book with you? I'd just like you to read a short section of it. On the bottom of page 31 to the shopkeeper's peculiarities.
Okay. Would you like me to read that?
I'd love it.
Sure. Europeans have been visiting New England for at least a century. Shorter than the natives, oddly dressed, and often unbearably dirty, the pallid foreigners had peculiar blue eyes that peeped out of the masks of bristly, animal-like hair that encased their faces. They are irritatingly garrulous, prone to fits of chicanery, and often surprisingly incompetent at what seemed to Indians like basic tasks. But they also made useful and beautiful goods, copper kettles, glittering colored glass, steel knives and hatchets, unlike anything else in New England. Moreover, they would exchange these valuable items for cheap furs of the sort used by Indians as blankets. It was like happening upon a dingy kiosk that would swap fancy electronic goods for customers' used socks. Almost anyone would be willing to overlook the shopkeeper's peculiarities.
That takes place in 1621. I guess that's when...
Right. I mean, one of the sort of odd things, I'm writing a book about, you know, the Americas before Columbus, but one of the most valuable accounts we have are, of course, all the colonists' reports, the colonial chronicles after Columbus, by people who had not yet, you know, been changed much by contact. And so even though my book is before Columbus, there are bits and pieces of it that talk about, you know, things that came afterwards to try and give you an idea. They're windows into the past, I guess.
And that's some of the parts of the book that are so valuable, to see that kind of confrontation of two cultures. You know, the native culture in this region that you talk about of New England really does seem, at the risk of romanticizing, to have been quite an improvement over that of the whites. I mean, for example, their attitudes towards children. You know, you say that the goal was to mold character. You didn't have any child labor. You know, the Indians thought it was quite peculiar the whole way that the colonists treated their children.
That's something that's very clear in the accounts. And the funny thing, of course, is that the pilgrims and the Europeans came, thought that the Indians spoiled their children dreadfully by letting them have a childhood. And you see this again and again as kind of disapproval. There's a book by the French historian Philippe Arius that's written about how the Europeans conceived of childhood, and they just simply didn't have the modern concept of childhood. And children were these dangerous creatures that had to be tamed and brought into society. And the Indians, you know, to modernize, had a much more congenial conception of childhood. You know, there's so many things that that when you look at the old colonial chronicles, it brings you up short, because Europeans, our ancestors, were very different than us, and it's almost like looking at two very foreign populations, and their interactions are fascinating. And it's also fascinating to see that, to some extent, the especially the Indians, I think, in New England, feel more modern, at least to me, than the Europeans who are my ancestors.
And actually, that's because we learn so much from them. One of the things that you talk about is how the concept of individual liberty, we took so much from that. In fact, what we think of as the post-conquest American character has so much to do with the Algonquin Federation. I know we went to school, you know, in grade school. I can remember hearing how our Constitution is based on, or is it the Iroquois or the Algonquin, or is that the same thing?
The Iroquois, right, the Iroquois Alliance, which is actually a group of six Native American societies.
But it's more than just a constitutional document. It's a much more pervasive kind of influence that they've had on the American character. I wonder if you could talk about that.
This is an interesting issue, and it's very much a live political issue in tremendous dispute. But I think it's unquestionable that if you read colonial accounts, again and again, they're struck by the Indians' insistence, and this is in the Northeast, I should say, the Northeastern groups, the Algonquin and Iroquoian-speaking societies of New England and a little bit further west and north, their insistence on personal liberty. The leaders of these groups, you know, were not absolute authorities in the way that kings were. And they had to, particularly in the case of the Iroquois Confederation, they had to cajole their subjects. They couldn't do anything without the approval of their subjects. And they also did not have social classes in the way that the Europeans did. And it's quite striking to see how much their social attitudes then become like what Europeans complain about Americans in the 19th century. You know, when your 19th century visitors come to the Americas, they're always complaining about how the Americans are sort of insubordinate, don't treat their betters respectfully enough, have this insistence on personal liberty. And it's also quite striking, if you draw a map, that the southeast of what is now the United States, the Indian societies there were very hierarchical and had a kind of slavery and eagerly participated in the slave trade in the southeast. And the ones in the northeast had nothing to do with it and refused to participate and thought it was an affront. And the tribal divisions on these lines pretty much mirror the Mason-Dixon line. And it's just a really striking thing. And it's hard not to say, gee, these people's lives were entwined for centuries. How is it possible that their attitudes did not have an effect on the colonial attitudes?
I mean, I always thought all men are created equal was an Enlightenment idea, but you could argue that it was an Iroquoian idea.
Well, you know, it certainly was an ideal, and there's tons of stuff from the European political tradition that play into it. So this is a source of, you know, the American character, certainly not the source. But at the same time, I don't think you can underestimate the impact of having a model, you know, a living, breathing exemplar of liberty walking around in front of you. And one of the things that's also striking is the continual complaints about colonists that, you know, when things were going bad, when their society started getting creeping towards the authoritarian, colonists are peeling off and joining the Indians. And there is much more, there's much more traffic that way. They could never persuade the Indians to come live in the colonies, but there's lots and lots of colonists, including some of my own ancestors, who at least temporarily peeled off and joined and lived with the Indians.
And in fact, colonists who became captives of the Indians tended to elect to stay with them.
Yes, and it was very difficult to persuade them to come back, whereas when the colonists captured Indians, they fled as often as they could. And there's a funny letter from Benjamin Franklin sort of scratching his head and lamenting this. Now, Franklin was really, you know, no friend to the Indians, so obviously he respected them. But if you read between the lines his letter, not very deeply between the lines, you have to see that these Indian societies just outside, you know, the next-door neighbors, were deeply attractive to the colonists, to many people, especially on the bottom of the social strata, who looked there and said, I'd rather be free and not have to defer to these societies in New England.
I almost wonder if the Indians had an impact on the Enlightenment itself, on the ideas of Rousseau or Voltaire or folks like that.
Well, certainly the idea of the noble savage did, and that was a kind of a distorted view of the Indians, especially on Rousseau, but also on Voltaire and lots of others, who viewed them, you know, through a distorted lens, because they obviously didn't come over here and do anthropological studies, but viewed them as exemplars of human liberty. Now, they saw it as a kind of a primitive state, but I don't think there's any question, if you read this stuff, that the Indians and their example of another way of living didn't play a role in their thought.
Next week, we'll talk with Charles C. Mann about his new book, 1493, and it's just as good as 1491. And you can read an excerpt from 1491 at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.